You're listening to 89.1 KMUW. Author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Timothy Egan often delves into history with his writing. He did so in his personal life, too. Prompted by his Irish Catholic family's complicated history with the church, Egan decided to find answers by walking one of the oldest pilgrimage trails in the world, taking him from Canterbury to Rome and a hopeful audience with the Pope. KMUW's Beth Golay spoke with Egan about his book, A Pilgrimage to Eternity, a personal journey he's been reluctant to tell before now.
You are known for your creative nonfiction, your book about the Dust Bowl, The Worst Hard Time. This, too, is a work of nonfiction. The title is A Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of Faith. So even though this is creative nonfiction, it's a bit of a departure because it's personal. So why did you decide to go on this pilgrimage? What was going on in your life at that time?
You know, I decided to follow the Via Francigena, which is an older pilgrimage. It was once the most popular. It's about 1,100 miles. It's through glorious country. It's through extraordinary shrines and places where so many events happen. And I was motivated by a sense of, I felt complacent in my own beliefs. I felt that I hadn't pushed myself. I was motivated by my mother's death. She was a very devout Catholic. And on her deathbed, she said she wasn't sure what was ahead. She had her doubts. And that sort of percolated down in me and popped up later. And then just at the dawn of the Trump era, where so many of our, you know, assumptions about our institutions have been shaken, I wanted to look for something more durable.
And you chose this route because did you write in the book that it was more of a thinker's route where people
yeah.
could contemplate along the way? Is that right?
Exactly, Beth. Via Francigena is sometimes called the thinking man's pilgrimage or the thinking person's pilgrimage. And gaining in popularity, again, even as religion is declining in Europe, one of the terms I heard when I was out on the trail, and it really applies to me, is this term of deep walking, where, you know, every day you're out walking towards something. Sometimes you're not even sure, but it gives you a chance to think and to press these issues. And this is not a rich person's pursuit either. I've met a lot of students, a lot of teachers. You're staying in monasteries, you're staying in hostels, you're staying in people's homes. Sometimes you're staying in hotels, but you're trying to move towards something. And in my case, I was trying to resolve and really think through these issues through this process of deep walking. And before I got injured, I would try to do about 18 to 20 miles a day.
You wanted to meet Pope Francis. You started in Canterbury, where, you know, I loved the learning the fact, like, the Bishop of Canterbury is one of the few people who can actually touch the Queen. But you were going to Rome, and you wanted to meet Pope Francis. To say what?
You know, my own faith is troubled. Like half of all American Catholics, I'm a lapsed Catholic. But when this Pope came in, I was very encouraged by all the things he said about returning Christianity to its roots, about treating the least among us, you know, as we would God himself, about, you know, respect for the poor, for the people who are marginalized. And so I thought I would give him a second chance. And so I describe myself now as a lapsed but listening Catholic. But also, you know, they have this horrible worldwide crisis in sexual abuse among clerics, and it's touched my family as well. So one of the tough things is whether I could forgive this institution for the pain it had caused my family. So yeah, I'm very encouraged by the openness of Francis and by his humility. I mean, this is a guy who washes the feet of the poor. The poor people don't kiss his feet. He goes out of his way to help migrants, help prisoners. He seemed to express the sort of the best of what the gospel represented.
You know, and about halfway into your pilgrimage, after you had reached out ahead of time and learned that your letter had been delivered directly to Francis and that he was, quote, considering your words, what did you think at that moment?
It sort of made me shiver. I mean, this is arguably the world's now most popular figure, and he's heads this church of, you know, 1.3 billion Catholics. There's 2.3 billion Christians, but 1.3 billion Roman Catholics, and he's a person I've greatly admired. To know that he was holding in his hands the words that I sent him was humbling, and it actually gave me chills. You know, you have ups and downs, you have good days and bad days when you take one of these pilgrimages, and this is one of the great things to keep me moving.
Okay, so talk to me a little bit about the journey. The pilgrimage, it takes about 10 weeks, is that right?
Yeah, and I did it in two parts because I got injured in the middle of it. And it is, I'll just say this, it's spectacular. It's really extraordinary country, especially as you start to get into the Swiss Alps. And it starts in Canterbury, goes to the cliffs of Dover, crosses the English Channel, goes through the Flanders Fields, where all those boys were buried from World War One, wends its way through some of the high shrines of Christianity in France, where all the kings of France were crowned by oil from brought down by a dove from God, into Switzerland, into the Alps, and then finally in Italy, which is, the landscape is so magical, and it's so infused with mysticism and spirituality, and the Italians really love pilgrims. People would come out and embrace me, sometimes kiss me. They would say, bravo, pellegrino, you know, because they really embrace people walking the Via Francigena in that part. And then the last 100 kilometers to Rome, where you go down the Via Antica, which is an old Roman road, now part of the Via Francigena, and you march straight into the Vatican.
Can you break down, like, you wanted to do the pilgrimage on foot, on two wheels, four wheels, train, you know, there was a mention of an Uber. Can you break right. down percentages? How true were you to...
Yeah, well, you know, my goal, as I say at the very start of the book, I'm trying to be very transparent with the reader about my motivation for pilgrimage, but also just about my mode of transport. My main thing was just to see and touch all the shrines along the way, the places that were first marked in the year 990 by the Archbishop of Canterbury. I would say about half of the 1,100-mile journey I did on foot. The rest was mostly local trains. You stick a train, you know, 20 miles down to the next village. And there was one point when I was so badly injured and there was no train service that my daughter had joined me at this point. We had to rent a car, and it led to a series of fairly ridiculous episodes. And that was all because I didn't listen, which I got this great advice from a priest in this monastery in the Alps during a snowy night. And I asked him, what is the best advice you can give a pilgrim on the Via Francigena? And he smiled and he said, listen. And I didn't listen to my body, and that led to these terrible blisters, which took me, you know, I couldn't walk for several weeks.
You know, there was a phrase you introduced me to, dropping weight. There was mm-hmm. a moment when you decided to take some stuff out of your backpack, and you, mm-hmm. I'm going to quote this, and you said, I leave my little donation in the church feeling at least 4 pounds lighter and a pound more righteous. And you also mentioned it later when your wife came over there. Can you explain what dropping weight is?
Yeah, I think of it like my metaphor for dropping weight is like the lunar capsule, the lunar launch as it gets towards the moon. It starts out as a big rocket as it leaves the United States, and as it gets toward the moon, it's a tiny little module. Also, the wagon train, which I live in the West, and the people who took the Oregon Trail long ago would start out with all their belongings, you know, in a wagon as they moved west. And by the time they crossed the Columbia River in Oregon, the Oregon country, they were down to just the bare minimums. And it's both metaphorical and actual. It's actual in that I was so glad to leave behind some things and donate. But in actuality, I was happy to be lighter as well. The metaphor is I'm freeing myself of some of the baggage that I'm trying to get rid of, my emotional baggage.
You know, I kind of want to get back to the clerical abuse, because you grew up in the Spokane Diocese, is that right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And, you know, one of the chapters where you wrote about Father Pat or Father Patrick O'Donnell,
yeah.
I mean, it was a bit of a departure from this journey because you were going back in time. And I can imagine, even though you were not physically abused, it must have been... difficult to write.
The chapter on the sexual abuse, clerical abuse, was very difficult to write. But I felt in the interest of honesty to the reader, I had to tell this story, because how are they to understand my pilgrimage if they don't understand my complicated feelings about this church? And it's the largest crisis facing the church right now. They have an existential crisis. Not since the Reformation of 500 years ago have they been so troubled. And it's touched us deeply. It hurt us deeply. Two of my brother's friends committed suicide. It was really hurt our family. And so I thought I owed it to the reader to explain this at some point so that the reader would understand the kind of stuff I'm carrying as I'm walking toward Rome. I talked about emotional baggage, and this is part of it, is can I forgive this church? And I think one of the reasons why 50% of American Catholics are lapsed right now is because that's all they hear about is this crisis of sexual abuse. So that affected me deeply, and it made me sort of typical of American Catholics.
Do you believe in miracles?
You know, let me just back up for a second.
Sorry, I took a big jump
no,
there.
That's
sorry.
It's a very good question. And you're the first person to ask me directly. Everyone just waits for that. 80% of Americans believe in miracles, and I started out as a skeptic. I'm a journalist as well by profession. And most journalists are fairly skeptical. Our attitude is prove it to me. But I've come around to a somewhat different point of view, which I suppose would put me more on the believing side, because something happened on my pilgrimage that was inexplicable. And I also sort of drilled down on some of the information on miracles, looked at the medical examinations of the 80 or so cases that they can't explain at the Shrine of Lourdes, and I've come to believe that there's something to it. So my belief is, I quote St. Augustine on this, on miracles. He says, miracles are not contrary to nature. They're contrary to what we know about nature. And so that's probably where I ended up.